Consider this noise. And compare it with this one. It's amazing, isn't it, that two pieces of music so distinct and so different can be rammed down the one ear. But curious juxtapositions like that happen every day to the side of our heads when we turn the radio on. One minute we can be in the company of Radio 1's Steve Lamacq.
Next on the session, from Wales, this is Catatonia.
And the next can be spent with Radio 4's Jenny Murray.
All right, here we go then. Go. And knock and knock and down and down. Up, knock and knock and down. That's it. Stretch more. Up.
Just some of the magnificent sounds available at the flick of a switch. Hello.
Hello.
I'm Armando Iannucci.
Standing erect, he was 6'4" tall.
And over the next 5 programs, I'll be filling what would otherwise be an embarrassing sequence of 15-minute gaps in the schedules with a series of sounds and noises, some of them disturbing, some of them fruity, but all of them offered in homage to the shocking versatility of the ear, the only organ in our body that is the shape of Ireland. Along the way, I'll be squelching a cotton bud around the ear's best friend, the radio, a box of noise which has brought untold joy and Chris Dunkley to millions of grateful home counties listeners across the globe. I'll be charting the history of radio from the early days when the pips were played by a 40-piece orchestra in the studio.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Peter Hobday and Chris Lowe. It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 8th of March. The headlines this morning.
Two present-day advances in satellite radio, including Radio 4's Breakaway, whose presenter Eddie Mayer now regularly broadcasts from a satellite studio orbiting the Earth's atmosphere.
Report copying. Good.
But if people get a relatively low price for their flight from Manchester, mm-hmm. they go to the Cayman Islands and have a good time.
Check all that is.
Tremendous.
Where's the problem?
There's no problem there.
So come with me as I take some recording equipment down your ear. It's a sonic journey which, though messy, I hope leaves you with a pleasant aftertaste in your ear's mouth. In the beginning was the word, and the word was good morning.
Good morning.
The word crawled out of the ether, and after several millennia, split into two.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Soon, other words were to come.
You can popple for
the handbag, Marilyn Monroe lips.
Corgi.
Nitty gritty ankles.
Bludgeon.
Mrs. Seltrow.
Crime buster.
Cross-leg tailor.
Patrician.
Camel's milk.
Purely random at first, but nevertheless a sign that what separated man from the beasts of the field was his overwhelming desire to broadcast. By the middle of the 20th century, he was able to broadcast joined-up sentences, albeit very primitive ones.
The bishops will then go on to... say...
At this stage, he was still no more than a burbling idiot. But soon the broadcasting animal managed to construct a microphone and went out gathering material. This was the end of the age of innocence.
Excuse me, I wonder if I might sit next to you and talk to you.
Yes, Miss President.
What are you doing in the centre of Manchester?
I'm waiting for a boyfriend to come.
Boyfriend?
Yes, I'm a homosexual.
How do you feel about being a homosexual?
Historians and archaeologists have catalogued a profound inclination within man towards radio presentation, dating back thousands of years. Early hill tribes in Sumatra were known to have built radio sets out of flint and parsley, and the austere rocks of Stonehenge may be the remains of an early FM transmitter. Primitive travel information has been found daubed in boar's blood on caves in southern France, and recent digs have uncovered beneath the pyramids a perfectly preserved continuity suite in the tomb of Pharaoh Ramesses II, complete with papyrus recording tape. Perhaps the most majestic example of this prehistoric worship of the magic of radio can be found on the barren shoreline of the Easter Islands, where standing carved in the cliff rock are 40 giant stone representations of Libby Purvis's face. Men and women are irresistibly drawn towards radio, like a baboon to a car aerial. Radio is like a womb, a warm concatenation of sounds and comforting burbles inside a small sac. And indeed, scientists and paediatricians have discovered that the sound of the womb rather resembles that of the theme tune to You and Yours. Of course, the womb analogy can only be taken so far, otherwise Chris Searle would be placenta. But it is interesting how loyal and attached we become to our radio, in a way that we don't with our television or vacuum cleaner. A company brings out a new function button on electrical equipment, and we all go out and buy the latest model. A BBC controller changes the radio schedules, and we put dead wood pigeons through his letterbox. So how did it all begin? Radio first achieved mass popularity in the early days of the 20s and 30s, when test signals were broadcast from the top of Marconi. The test signals became immensely popular, and soon families all across the country were avidly tuning in while sitting down to Sunday lunch. Here's a celebrated one from 1923. And from 1927, the Alexandra Palace test signal, regarded as one of the funniest of its generation, and which ran for 14 years. This was the golden age of silent radio, and that last extract featured its biggest star, Pepe McPhee, a silent radio clown who never quite survived the transition to the talkies. He died penniless in Crewe in 1968, 3 years after making a sad comeback playing the pauses on Radio 3. But he wasn't all that important, so let's move on now to the 30s and the dawn of sound. Talking radio began in 1931 with his very first letter from America by Alistair Cook, who was 12.
Oh, well, I went out fishing while I was at camp, and I went out on an overnight hike. And while I was out fishing, I caught 2 fish, but the other boy that was with me caught 11.
1934 saw the start of Woman's Hour.
I want to talk to you this morning about clothes and boots and shoes.
And in 1938, the very first episode of The Archers. It's a little-known fact that this much-loved CAC soap opera was originally commissioned by the Ministry of Agriculture as a means of getting across vital farming information to farmers in an entertaining way. This origin is evident if we listen to a clip from one of the earliest programmes.
Good morning. More on the threat from warble flies and brucellosis to the national cattle herd. Joining me from our Guildford studio is Keith Meldrum, the government's chief vet. Good morning, Mr. Meldrum.
Good morning to you.
Have you contained these outbreaks of warble fly and brucellosis yet?
I believe we have contained the outbreaks of brucellosis, although we have not yet found the origin, so the tracing work continues.
That's brucellosis, but what about warble flies?
The warble fly story is rather more worrying.
Goodbye.
As talking radio took off, there was a greater and greater demand for new and original noises. The public were bored with conventional bangs and thuds and eagerly lapped up the most recently released sound. British engineers were at the forefront of noise development. Cambridge physicist Sir Raleigh Craven invented the whoosh in 1934, while in 1938 a joint Anglo-American team led by Philip Oppenheimer discovered slurping. But the great breakthrough came in 1939. Using a process known as sound fusion, scientists were able to split the plop and a whip and generate a highly unstable pip. After some more refinement, Britain perfected its powerful new sonic weapon. With the pip, man at last had the power to check his watch, and the history of the world would never be the same again. The pip was handed over to the Americans for safekeeping, and President Roosevelt went on live radio to announce that he and he alone would be the one to decide when to use it.
There is no job like it on the face of the earth. In the power which is concentrated here at this desk, and in the responsibility and difficulty of the decision.
To this day, on the Oval Office wall is a plaque saying, "The pip stops here." During the war, the manufacture of pips was trebled. Correct timing was very vital for Allied bombing campaigns, and pensioners and housewives were called up to help in the war effort. Here's a clip from a 1942 documentary, Pip Pip Hooray, recounting a new recruit's first day at the pip factory.
Here we are, alongside the lathe with Mr. Nash, your instructor.
Good morning, Mrs. Smith.
Good morning, Mr. Good morning.
Joe, have you had any experience with machines before?
Only a sewing machine.
Only a sewing machine? Well, it's rather a big jump from a sewing machine to a 5-inch centre lathe, but you'll soon get used to it.
Well, Mr. Anderson, you're the trainer. How is she filing? Oh, Mrs. Pearl, shall I see you? How you're getting on? Yes, looks very nice. Now, let me just hear you file again, shall I? You listen to this trainee filing. Yes. A little tentative, I think. Now listen to the expert. Now you listen to the different song, little sing. Now listen, different sound. Look. Well, Mr. Anderson, how do you find the ladies take to this? On the whole, really well. I think they're very adaptable.
Throughout the early 40s, the war rumbled on, thanks mainly to a rumbling sound unleashed by the Germans. To boost morale in the front line, radio programs were sent out overseas to play to the forces. This happened to start the week with Melvin Bragg, which was airdropped over Burma in 1944. The program was never heard of again, and for years people assumed it had gone missing in action. Then, in 1978, it was spotted staggering out of the Burmese jungle, where it had been hiding for over 30 years, unaware that the Second World War had ended. People were horrified at the state of Melvin Bragg, now a shattered husk of his former self.
We've all been talking this morning about it, and it does make you mad when the young ones look and think that you haven't got any life left in you. They don't know what's inside you. I go to dances and I get compliments paid me. I still do, and I like it.
His broadcasting companion, Nigella Lawson, was in an even more pathetic state.
I'm 70. I don't feel 70, I feel about 20 half the time.
Meanwhile, at home, radio comedy kept the nation happy. All the comedy greats were in their prime at this period. Tommy Trinder, Jimmy Jewell, and of course, Federico Fellini, who went on to better things. Fellini was the star of Educating Archie, a peculiar hit since, despite being on radio, its principal character was a 34-year-old Italian who spoke no word of English. Here's a clip of Fellini in the famous Door sketch.
Now, I sent you out hours ago to book my cabin on the boat. What's taken you so long?
È la più gigantesca dimostrazione.
You went to Queen Charlotte's Hospital to book me a berth? Oh, they must have thought you were mad.
È la storia della patria. 20 milioni.
After the war, radio was allowed to be noisy again, and in a flurry of optimism and excitement, the BBC unveiled at the Festival of Britain the new big band Pips.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with John Humphreys and Graham Leach. It's 7 o'clock on Friday the 16th of April.
The horrific events that happened to our ears in the four decades since then are the stuff of every history class. But if you're not too familiar with them, then join me for another scratch down your ear. If you are, then come anyway, because you might stumble across some fond memories from the decade of swing.
And you're listening to Today on Radio 4 with John Humphreys and Peter Hobday. It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 4th of October.
Goodbye.